all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 14916, Dela Cruz v. Quemado. Arguing for the petitioner, Joseph P. H. Ahuna, Jr. Also appearing for the petitioner, David K. Ahuna. Arguing for respondent, John Aaron Murphy-Jones. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Ahuna and Mr. Murphy-Jones. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning.
Are you ready? Both ready to proceed? All right. So, Mr. Ahuna, you've reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Murphy, is Murphy-Jones, correct?
John Aaron.
All right. Mr. Murphy-Jones, please, 10-minute warning at the end.
Yes.
All right. Please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. We're grateful to be here for the opportunity to share our thoughts about this particular case. You know, first of all, just to let you know that we did not receive an amended supplemental brief at all from Mr. Jones, as the court had ordered him to do so. I talked to Mr. Jones, and he said he did not file one. I think the court had ordered him to amend his prior brief and to submit it 20 pages, and he did not.
Very well. Let's proceed with the argument. Thank you, Mr.
You know, the question here, the several questions which the court has asked, I'd like to address those questions with questions of itself. First question is, you know, does the courts have the power to hold a party in default? And it's clear, you know, that the courts do. They can hold a party in default. And in this case, it's undisputed. He didn't show up for a settlement conference on 2/13/13.
Can a court hold somebody in default for just not appearing at settlement conference? I mean, just
for not showing up? I said by itself, no. I don't think so. But unless the cases that we looked at, it shows a pattern that if you have a justifiable excuse or you have a reason to explain why you didn't show up. Or if you've done some action, some affirmative acts, such as trying to get an extension, like for example, in the case clearly show that when you do something, and the court still denies your motion to set aside, then it will be.
Maybe I wasn't very clear because you just said if there's a motion to set aside. My question is before that. My question is. Can you default someone without giving them the right to be heard before you do it? In other words, I mean, the party could have had an automobile accident. I mean, there could be a myriad of reasons. And the way the rule is structured, it says, unless a good cause for such failure is shown. So my question is, does a court have to give the party that it's entering default the right to be heard? To explain why it apparently didn't follow the court rules.
You know, in this case, yes, they do. And a lot of times, that's where they have the motion to set aside is given. That's where they file the motion to set aside to give them the opportunity to explain what happened. So, you know, the courts, they have a discretion where they can, according to the rules, put a person default for not showing up. And if they have a valid excuse, they file a motion to set aside. And that's the pattern, that's where the law's worked out because that's what happens and that's where you get to present the reason. Yes.
So is your answer to my question no, that a court does not have to give a party the chance to be heard before it enters default because it can allow that person to be heard on the motion to set aside?
Yes.
That's your position?
That's my position.
Regardless if the rule seems to indicate otherwise.
And that's the position where the case law has indicated because a lot of times they enter default and then they move to set aside. And that's where the procedures are set up. Because then in that case, what would happen is that there would be a chilling effect in the sense that basically the fear of being held in default would become will lose its teeth. You know, but the judges have the right to say, hey, don't show up. We'll hold you default.
In order to show cause why your case, why default shouldn't be entered, isn't a chilling sort of thing to be concerned about? I mean, people are just going to randomly or systematically violate rules because they're going to gamble on order to show causes?
If they're not held in default, yes, they will disregard it. So you know what? Sure, I don't need to show up because the judge is going to ask for a hearing, and I can spend it there at that time.
But doesn't the court have the right to put attorney fees and all costs and all kinds of other alternative sanctions at the order to show cause hearing?
They have that option. It's within the discretion of the judge. And so the judge, a lot of times, will look at not only that isolated instance, but will look at other prior acts of omissions, the things they did, to determine whether or not to hold them in default or not. So the thing is that we don't want to take away the discretion from the judges to do.
But this default was entered for the failure to appear at the settlement conference,
yes.
Correct? Now, and so that's a Rule 12.1
yes.
default.
Yes.
But didn't the ICA rule in Kamaunu versus Kaaea in 2002 that the circuit court abused its discretion in entering a default liability based on, and the facts are a little bit different, because in that case, the defendant refused to offer anything in settlement. Uh-huh. And so the court entered default on the basis that the defendant refused to offer anything in settlement.
Okay.
But that was a Rule 12.1 sanction. Uh-huh. And the ICA, at least, ruled that that was an abuse of discretion.
Uh-huh.
And it actually violated the defendant's right to have liability determined by a jury. And in this case, this was a jury. I know these are issues that aren't raised, but... this was a jury trial, right? Scheduled
correct.
For jury
yes.
trial.
Yes.
It was scheduled for jury trial in April, correct?
Yes.
And he failed to appear, and the defendants have failed to appear in a March 2013, a February settlement conference.
Yes.
In March, he moved to set it aside,
yes.
saying that I didn't know about it.
Yes.
All right. And so my understanding is that... the settlement conference was set and in an April 2012 trial setting status conference.
Yes.
At which he had actually not appeared.
Yes.
But apparently the court had sent the trial setting order to his office.
Yes.
But he said, I was in the process of moving. I never received it.
Yes.
And I didn't know about the settlement conference. How is it not an abuse of discretion not to grant the motion to set aside the entry of default?
The trial hadn't
even happened, and apparently this case, as he said, was filed in 2008, and there were at least six, perhaps eight, motions to ex parte motions to extend time for filing a pretrial statement. And based on my review of the record, it appears it's because, you know, you were trying to figure out whether there was homeowners coverage.
Yes.
Apparently, I'm assuming there wasn't because there is no insurance defense being provided here. But in any event, you folks continued this trial for case for five years, and then he says, I wasn't there, I didn't get it, hey, give my client her trial. And the judge denies the motion to set aside entry of default. How is that not an abuse of discretion?
I think it's really simple. If you look at the cases, there's a pattern. In the cases that they held, those inexcusable neglect, the pattern is that in those cases, they did nothing. They did not file a motion to extend. They did not answer the complaint. They were kind of like an ostrich with his head stuck in the sand.
Excuse me. The entry default was entered. He immediately filed to set it aside. That was denied. He files motions for, wasn't there at least one or two motions for recon on the entry of default issue?
A witness list was filed, I think.
Let me explain. The reasons that he gave, he claims, you have to have some justification. This is a pattern that,
But that wasn't, the judge didn't rule based on a pattern. The judge said, you didn't appear at the settlement conference, and therefore I'm entering a default. It was a 12.1 entry of default, and the ICA had already ruled in 2002 that it's an abuse of discretion to enter default on liability based on a settlement conference issue.
It was more than that.
Okay, where's the entry of default?
Well, what the entry of default says, it looks like to me it all is related to the settlement conference. It says, failed to appear at a scheduled settlement conference, failed to discuss or attempt to negotiate a settlement prior to the conference, failed to have a person authorized to settle the case present at the conference, and failed to deliver a confidential letter. Everything is related to the settlement conference, and if you don't know about it, you would have been in violation of all of those provisions.
Again, my point is that the question is, was there a justification for not doing those things?
Well, maybe this is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but maybe this is a point where you could help me, Mr. Ahuna, with the consequence of the default and the actions that were taken as a consequence of the default, where there was a motion to set aside the default, and then there was action by the court that denied the motion to set aside, and then court, of course, went ahead and dismissed your claims. But I'm interested in the reaction, the reaction of the court, not including a hearing. I mean, there was a motion to set aside the default, and there wasn't even a hearing held. To what extent do you think it was necessary, and did you participate at all in a decision that, if I understand correctly, the court made to deny the motion to set aside without a hearing?
I believe there was a hearing, and we showed up at the hearing, and we filed a memo in opposition, and there was a hearing, and...
But a hearing at what point?
At the hearing, the motion to set aside.
Which motion to set aside?
The motion to set aside the entry of default.
Which, the original one, the March 13th one?
The March 13th, there was only one motion for set aside. There was a confusion when he called the default judgment, but
right.
The first one that he did was there's another one, motion set aside default judgment.
Wasn't the motion for reconsideration denied without a hearing?
There was a hearing for the motion to set aside this default.
But the motion for reconsideration, wasn't there a motion for reconsideration?
Yes, there was no hearing for that.
And why was that? Or do you think that it wasn't necessary to have a hearing when there's a motion for reconsideration? Because this is a pretty strong sanction, wouldn't you say, entry of default?
It would be a strong sanction if there was excusable neglect. If there was inexcusable neglect, it would be a proper sanction.
But what about the argument that he didn't receive notice of the hearing?
You know, that's the argument that he says. That we submit that the court did, in fact, give him a copy, the mailed copy of the trial setting order.
How did he give it? I thought it was mailed.
It was mailed to him, excuse me. He received the copy of it. Well, it was mailed to him.
Mr. Ahuna, and didn't counsel attest that he asked the U.S. Postal Service to forward the mail and he didn't get the mail?
Whether that occurred or not, I'm not really sure. That's what he is saying.
Well, but that's in his statement, right? Okay. So why is that not excusable neglect?
I think the inexcusable neglect would be in this case that if he knew that we had a trial setting conference scheduled, he knew that for sure because he had rescheduled it to April 10th and yet does not attend to that status conference meeting, that he should have, at the very least, made effort to find out what happened.
Let's assume that he messed up. Let's assume that he miscalendered it. Let's assume that he just made a mistake, which is not unheard of for most of us. Should you have your plaintiff's case entirely tossed, default entered? I mean, aren't there more appropriate sanctions, for example, attorney fees and other matters, than to toss out a 5-year-old case?
Actually enter liability against the defendant, right?
So the question is whether or not this is an appropriate sanction for given he made a mistake and all those things. And I would address it in two questions. Number one, was there a showing? I think in some of the case law shows there must be a showing to explain, you know, why or what prevented him from knowing about these things. If he says, I didn't know, well, at the very least, he should have tried to make effort to find out because he knew, at the very least, he knew there was a trial setting conference out. He knew about it. Why didn't he go inquire? You know, and you say it was a mistake. Well,
didn't he also say that, you know, I thought this case was going back into CAP?
You know, and that's a good point because the court had ordered us to send it back to CAP. And we did send him a copy of the stipulation to sign the, to send it back to CAP, yet he didn't sign it. He didn't sign it at all. So we tried to contact him several times to say, hey, you know, we'll send this back to CAP. I'm sending a stipulation to readmit it back to CAP. No response. No response. You know, as I said, he was like an ostrich sticking his head in the sand.
Okay. There's no response. I do notice, and he didn't raise this, so in a way it might not be fair, but I did notice that on the December 24, 2012, order denying plaintiff's request to readmit case to the court annexed arbitration program.
Yes.
It actually says, it is hereby ordered that plaintiff's request is hereby denied, and the above captioned matter shall remain in the court annexed arbitration program. Did you notice that? The order actually says we're denying your request to readmit, but the order actually says you're still going to be in the CAP program.
You know, I think that was probably a clerical error on their part because we kicked out of it. We weren't in it. So.
But technically, pursuant to this order, was the case still in CAP or was it not?
It was not.
Okay, because the title says that you're not being readmitted?
Yeah.
Well, even though the body of the order says that you're still in?
I believe if that issue was raised, I would have found the order in the record showing that it was taken out of CAP. But I believe that we were not in CAP and so it wasn't there. We had no mediator, no arbitrator was assigned to us. You know, there's nothing from the court annexation telling us, you know, who your mediator is going to be. There's no communication at all from them.
Mr. Hoon, I want to direct your attention to another part of the proceedings and ask your position on this. After you moved for entry of default judgment, the court conducted a hearing. And when it entered its findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order on that hearing, ruled that you had failed to establish liability on the part of the defendant. And I know you've argued that at length in the ICA and again in our briefings here, whether that ruling was correct or not. But I want to focus your attention on one aspect of the court's order and subsequent actions, which was entering judgment against the plaintiffs on their claims. Is that an aspect of this case that you believe the court could appropriately do, or an action you think the court could appropriately take, entering judgment against you on your claims, as opposed to simply denying your motion for default judgment?
Well, I'm not quite understanding.
Okay, let me try it. You moved for default judgment against the Kamados.
Yes.
The court ruled you had failed to make out your case and denied the motion, correct?
Yes.
Then the court entered judgment against you, your clients. Yes. Could the court do so? Enter judgment against you as opposed to simply denying your motion?
Simply deny my motion? Or I believe they denied the motion and entering judgment, I guess the same thing, has the same effect. Basically, our case gets against their...
Well, wait a minute. If a motion for default judgment is denied, isn't the next step a trial?
It was denied in the sense that... maybe I don't understand the question, but my understanding is that if it's a motion for default judgment denied, then, good question, then go to trial. Exactly.
The issue whether or not you were entitled to a trial if your motion for default judgment was denied?
Yes.
Did the defendant ever file for summary judgment?
No.
Wasn't this, in effect, a grant of summary judgment?
The effect was...
Did the defendant even testify at that hearing?
No.
It was only your clients, right?
Yes.
And didn't you have... weren't you suggesting that the defendant may present evidence that would be in your favor as to whether or not she had a duty?
Yes.
As to, you know, like she knew that her son was on drugs and, you know, was on parole,
right,
and yet she invites him down to examine this jury, says try it on, and then tells him, oh, they have another aluminum container filled with diamonds, good jewelry. Yes. Please bring that out so my son can see
yes.
it.
Okay, well, my question is, did you raise this issue in the trial court? Did you object to what the trial court was doing? Did you ask for reconsideration and say, Your Honor, we should have the ability to go forward, conduct discovery, and go to trial? Have you preserved this issue on appeal?
We had filed a motion for reconsideration. And
that motion essentially argued the court got it wrong on the law, yeah, and that you should have won your motion, prevailed on your motion, correct?
Yes.
All right. At any point did you tell the trial court, hey, wait a minute, even we dispute, Your Honor, respectfully, we disagree with your assessment of the law, but we would like the opportunity to conduct discovery and go forward to trial in this matter?
I can't recall if we made a specific request at that time, because we're focusing on the judge's denial of motion for default judgment, and the court basically said we had no claim at all against
no claim based on the record that existed,
yes,
at that time. Did you ask for the opportunity to further develop the record? That's my question.
At that time, no, we did not. We did not, because pretty much the claim had been against their claim had been dismissed. And we believe, before we get to that question, we need to get the first question is whether or not the court felt that there was any liability to begin with. If she felt there's no liability, further discovery won't show anything else, because we did present evidence at the hearing that she knew that the son had a drug problem.
Well, the judge, in a sense, decided the whole case. I mean, it was summary judgment. It was everything all rolled into one. Said there's no duty and just,
yes.
Well, while you're developing your case, the argument as to liability, Mr. Ohuna, let me ask you: did you anticipate you were going to have more discovery, or was your theory simply that there was a duty because the son happened to have a criminal record and he was exposed to the jewelry? Was there more that you wished to develop?
We believe that we had sufficient evidence that's presented, so further discovery would not produce more than what we already produced. And so it was, everything we had the affidavit, we had the law.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but then could you help me with your theory? The duty arose simply because the son had gone to prison and the mother decided, yeah, to invite him to see the jewelry?
That's a good case as far as I think Rule 302B talks about that in Touchette case, where you can be held, if you do an affirmative act. So the key is an affirmative act, and it creates an unreasonable risk of harm.
Okay, so the affirmative act was to allow the son to be there, to invite the son to be there to see the jewelry.
I think more than just allowing, more was enticing, inviting, and basically tempting him to see all of these jewelry, millions of dollars worth of jewelry, with the knowledge that she knew he was an convicted drug felon.
Did somebody put the wedding ring on the son?
I'm not sure who did it, but it was in the process of whether the mother did it or he did it himself. I'm not too sure with that right
okay,
now.
Okay, but in any event, by inviting him, by opening up the jury, and by putting somebody who has an obvious drug problem, somebody who's had their probation, parole, revoked, exposing him to, hey, there's $1 million worth of jewelry, come look at it, has him upstairs for 45 minutes or something like this, there's not some anticipation that somebody who has an ongoing drug problem may not feel like, oh, this is a way I can continue to get money for drugs? I mean,
sure, it's a...
Well, Mr. Ohuna, Justice Pollack just laid out a factual scenario, which I'm getting the sense is a complete one for you, but I didn't want to prevent you from adding to that scenario if that was part of your case, because it sounds like even though in this case the son had not been convicted of theft of any kind and he simply had a drug problem, your position is that there was a duty that arose. In other words, no parent should allow their child to be around valuable objects if they've been convicted of an offense that involves drugs. So I'm having a little difficulty with the reach of this duty. Is it simply arose from the fact that he'd been convicted of a drug offense?
I think the question, this is a motion for default judgment, and you need to look at all the facts, the law that was light most favorable to us.
Please go ahead. I'm interested in looking at this in the light most favorable to your case. But is there anything else? I mean, in other words, was there some indication that there was a discussion with the son about how this jewelry really looks good on you, you might want to think about getting jewelry like this, or was there some enticement that was at all direct in the sense that maybe someday you should consider buying this? Or
I think the enticement in this case was there in our brief, all the things that she did. But I thought the part that was really important to me was the fact that, you know, that she told him, by the way, there's an aluminum box, aluminum case here that has $1 million worth of jewelry inside, you know, and told my clients, hey, come on, show it to my son, show it to my son. And so they, based on that request, opened it up and showed it to the son. And, you know, the question you have, is there a connection between, you know, a person who has a drug conviction and is violent crime of robbery? And that seemed to be the concern of the judge below.
All right, but now you're getting back to this idea that simply because he'd been convicted, did it matter how long before he'd been convicted? Did you have any evidence that he was involved in some sort of florid moment in his addiction, that he still had, was there, do you have evidence that he had a continuing severe addiction?
All we know is that the key is what the mother had known, and that's the key that we focus on, what she knew, and in her admission she said that she knew that he was a drug user and had a conviction for drug possession.
So she said he was still a drug user.
He didn't say that he was still, but you know what, interesting, in her statement that we quoted out, you know, when she's saying, you know, oh, explain what happened, and she said something like, oh, you know what, my son is into drugs, that's why he do this kind of stuff.
Okay, well, the issue is whether or not it would be reasonably foreseeable to her that based on what she did, the son could try to steal some of the jewelry, correct?
Yes, and that's...
So is that a question of fact?
Yes, it is.
Or is that an issue that we get to decide as a matter of law that it's not reasonably foreseeable?
It'll be an issue of fact we propose, because foreseeability is an issue which we believe should be presented to the jury to determine.
And what assuming that the entry of default had been proper, and assuming per HUP, which the case cited by the ICA, it was permissible for the court to require additional proof of liability. By the way, did you know that she was going to require additional proof of liability when you showed up at that hearing, or did you think that it was a proof hearing on damages?
It was a proof hearing on damages.
You thought it was a proof hearing on damages.
Yes.
And you show up and she says, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to require you to actually establish facts to establish liability, right?
She
right.
Did, yes.
And so then the HUB case says that she can do that,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But in the HUB case, what actually happened was the trial court had denied the motion for default judgment after requiring additional proof of liability. And the ICA ruled that the standard applicable in that hearing was, did the plaintiff present sufficient evidence to withstand a motion for directed verdict, right?
Yes.
So, and in that case, the trial court denied the motion for default judgment. In this case, the court, instead of denying the motion for default judgment, and in the HUB case, the ICA said that the trial court was wrong because the plaintiff had presented sufficient evidence to withstand a motion for directed verdict, and the ICA said the plaintiff was entitled to the motion for default judgment and actually reversed the trial court. In this case, the trial court denied the motion for default judgment based on proof of liability requirements that apparently you didn't know she was going to require. Then, not only did she deny your motion for default judgment, she entered judgment against you, in effect granting summary judgment in favor of the defendant who had never moved for summary judgment. Is this a proper procedure?
The way you presented it? No, it's not. It's not a proper procedure.
Did you object to that procedure at the time it took place? And if not, why not?
You know, at the time, we believed that we didn't think of it as being turning into a summary judgment motion because nothing was raised by them.
OK. Okay, so then...
If they've raised that as a motion for summary judgment...
The findings of fact, conclusions of law come out, and at that point, it's quite apparent she's entering judgment against you. And when you do your recon focuses on her failure to enter judgment in your favor, and it does not, as I read it, object to the fact that she had entered judgment against you. So does that mean you've waived this argument?
No, it does not. Because, as I mentioned earlier, there's no motion by the defense, by the respondent, for motion for summary judgment in this case.
Of course. And so you might have been surprised at the hearing. You might have been surprised when you opened the findings of fact and conclusions of law. But once you read them, you realized the court had sua sponte, effectively, entered judgment against you. And my question is, at that point, did you object to what the court had done or ask the court to reconsider on that basis the fact that the court had entered judgment against you?
We basically, our motion for the effect of our motion for reconsideration was basically object to what the court did in this case, which in essence rendered judgment against us.
And in fact, what the court had done was, it seems to me, is made equivalent the denial of the default judgment and said, oh, I'm not going to grant default judgment because there's no duty, you lose as a matter of law, and so she enters judgment against you. To her, it was two sides of the same coin.
Okay. Mr. Ohuna, during the damages hearing, did you argue to the court that the defendant's counsel shouldn't be allowed to appear and argue on damages?
The court, whether I said that it should be allowed to not, I don't recall whether or not, but if we present our case, and I believe he was there, and whether or not he had made an argument, I don't recall offhand. But I believe that possibly the court may have told him that he could not because it's in default, but you know, something which I'm not clear about right now. But
you actually said, since they're not involved in this, that Mr. Jones be removed because they have nothing to do with this case, and asked that he be not allowed to be here because they're in default.
Okay. That refreshes my memory, and that is correct, because I, you know, basically...
What do you base that on?
We base it upon the fact that he was already in default. Entry default was already entered. And, you know, in that case, you know, I may have been, you know, just making my point. And
you think that under the law, if, assuming that this had actually been a proof hearing on damages,
yes,
which is what a standard motion for default judgment is about, but even in that situation, isn't it pretty clear that under the law, the defense still is allowed to be heard on the issue of damages? And in fact, isn't it pretty clear that under the law, if there's a demand for jury trial, the defense is still allowed his constitutional right to jury trial on the issue of damages, even if liability has been entered?
I believe you're correct. I believe you're correct in that aspect, that even entry default, he has a right to make his argument. However, you know, the thing is that he never raised objection. The issue is not on appeal, you know, and that's the part that...
he didn't really get a chance to object because he'd been told he was given a brief opportunity to speak, and then that was it. He was told to sit down at that point, correct?
Well, I could have filed some motions after that, and he could have raised it later on. Nothing was done in this case. And the court is bringing a lot of things that could have, should have been done, which was not done by their side. So is he kind of catching us on bringing up issues?
Well, why would he file a motion for recon when he won after that motion for default judgment? The judge just ruled that you had no case. Why in the world would he need to file a motion for recon?
Well, in opposition to our motion, he could have brought it up when we filed our memo in opposition, our memo for reconsideration of the order. He should have said, you know, on top of that, I was denied the right to
But again, he prevailed. No reason to challenge it, no reason to appeal.
And that's why we filed this appeal. Because we believe that the bottom line is that the court exceeded its bounds in denying our motion for default judgment. And that's my time is up.
All right. Well, because you're asking a lot of questions during the time, we'll give you some opportunity to respond to Mr.
Okay.
Jones's argument.
Sorry. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Jones, your arguments.
I would like to address the court first by saying that I have to accept responsibility for what happened in this case. I'm not trying to put this off on the plaintiff or anybody else. I've been practicing law for 44 years now, and this is the first case that I've had where it just got, it fell through the hole in the concrete or whatever. But in all honesty, 3 years ago, I wound up at Queens Hospital in intensive care with diabetes, and the whole my whole life changed. I shut down my office. I lost my apartment. The phones went dead, and I had to fight my way back. But those are ancillary things that happened along the way, and I'm not blaming that on the plaintiff's attorney. The court did ask about the issue of duty, and in my original brief, I cited a Florida case, Patrick Wells versus Michael, it looks like Hannigan. But the court talked about the issue of public policy in whether or not someone who has a drug problem should be allowed in to family meetings, family gatherings, or should they be excluded? And the Florida court said in a unanimous decision that these are the people who should be allowed in to the family. It should be kept in the family because that's what they need. And it should not be excluded based on the fact that they do or did have a drug problem.
Mr. Jones, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but accepting the proposition that you're suggesting that perhaps there's no duty, can you provide your view of the procedural point at which it would have been appropriate for the court to make that determination? In other words, in this case, you have a situation in which there you have a proof of damages hearing and question about whether entry of judgment should take place, and then the court decides, after granting default, the court decides something that you might well think the parties weren't ready for, which is to dismiss the claims. Now, what would be your view as to procedurally accepting your proposition there's no duty? At what point is it appropriate for the court to make a ruling finding no liability?
Well, once you review the Hub case that gives the court the right to hold a hearing, and then you're looking now at Carr versus Straub, it says that the non-moving party must show their prima facie case so that the appellants in this case had to show a prima facie case to recover anything. To move forward, they had to show their prima facie case, which showed duty, breach of duty, and causation.
Do you think that if you don't show, let's assume they didn't show the prima facie case in this hearing. If you don't show it, does that automatically mean you lose and your case is dismissed? Is there any law that says that's the consequence of failing in proof?
As opposed to just denying the motion for default judgment?
I'm back on Carr versus Straub, because in that case, I do believe the court dismissed it because they could not show duty and breach of duty. In this case, with Mrs. Quimado, the trial court said, look, you have not sustained your duty, your obligation to prove that there was a duty on her part and that she breached that duty.
But did you have a motion for summary judgment? Had you in any way asked the court to enter judgment against them? Was there a pending motion for summary judgment that you had filed or any other request that you had made in the context of that hearing for the court to go ahead and enter judgment against them as opposed to simply denying the motion and then moving forward?
No, there was not. But earlier we had filed earlier in this case, we filed a motion the equivalent, I believe, of a motion to dismiss, but...
And it was denied. The motion to dismiss was, it almost seems one could argue that the fact that the motion to dismiss was denied would almost govern the court in this and deny motion for default judgment. In other words, it's kind of the two rulings are almost contrary.
It does seem that way, Your Honor, except that when we did this in the initial stages, there still was no duty.
Mr. Jones, what could the basis be for the court to, isn't the plaintiff's attorney allowed some sort of notice before his case is dismissed? Are you saying this damages hearing, is that the notice?
I believe it is. As I was not allowed to proceed in that, and in fact, when I first sat down, he was quite adamant about me being forced to leave.
But isn't he entitled to notice before a judgment is entered against his client?
Basically, I said under the law, I would say yes, without a doubt.
Following up on Justice Nakayama's question, when you appeared at that hearing, why did you think you were there? Was it going to be a hearing on damages, or was it going to be a hearing on whether or not the plaintiff was able to prove liability?
I thought it was a liability.
You thought it was a liability hearing?
Yes, I did.
And why did you think that? What notice were you given that this was going to be a further hearing on the issue of liability and not a standard motion for default judgment, which is on damages only?
Going back to the prima facie case, he had never proved.
Well, the court had already entered default, right?
Yes, the court had entered a default. We asked for reconsideration.
And did his motion for default judgment say, give us a hearing on whether or not we have established liability, or did his motion for default judgment say, give us a hearing on damages?
I don't recall what hit on that issue, Your Honor. But I do recall when we filed for reconsideration coming forward, that we were asking for reconsideration to include the duty and the breach of duty. We harped on that point continually, because we knew that there was no duty that Mrs. Kimato owed to the plaintiffs. Now,
I just want to be clear on the record.
We don't generally have back and forth argument. You will have an opportunity to rebut, Mr. Ahuna. Thank you.
I just wanted to be clear on the record. You didn't get a hearing on your motion for reconsideration once the entry of default was entered. Is that correct?
That's correct, Judge. Your Honor.
Did you raise any new arguments in your motion for reconsideration that were not in your original motion for reconsideration that had been denied after a hearing? Because a motion for recon has to raise new arguments, correct?
That's correct.
So what new arguments did you raise in your motion for recon?
Had there been a hearing already? I thought that the default was entered.
Default was entered.
You asked for motion for reconsideration.
Yes, for reconsideration.
And was there a hearing granted?
Our motion for reconsideration was that we did not receive.
No, you had a hearing on that motion on April 23rd, 2013,
yes.
Correct?
That's correct.
Hearing on which motion?
On the motion of whether or not we had actually received actual notice. Is that what the court is referring to?
So you had the opportunity to argue to the judge whether you'd gotten notice or not of the settlement conference. Is that correct?
That was considered at that point.
Okay, but in a hearing before the judge, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And did the judge, you at that time presented your position that you had not received notice of the settlement conference, correct?
That's correct.
All right. And was there any evidence put in to the contrary to suggest that you, in fact, had gotten notice?
I don't believe anything was entered at that time. She just proceeded onward. She said, well, you did receive that back several months earlier, way back, maybe a year earlier.
Why did you file a naming of witnesses on March 1st, 2013?
That's where I thought we were with this case.
You thought you had a trial in April?
It was my opinion that I was going to file my witnesses because it was timely made. It was being timely made. And that's when I found out that the default, that's when I got the notice that the default had been entered. And I got that from the
plaintiff. I actually don't have the court's attachment to her trial setting order. Did her trial setting order require that you file a naming of witnesses by March 1st?
No, I don't believe it did, but I normally file my witness list within a year, within 1 year, but in this case there were so many continuances and I hadn't done it, so I said, well, I better go ahead and file one anyway.
You hadn't filed a responsive pretrial statement?
No.
So that was your first witness naming?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. But under the rules, we were supposed to have a statement of readiness, what, every year or every 6 months? I can't remember.
Mr. Jones?
That actually doesn't apply in the First Circuit.
Yes.
Could I ask you about the award of attorney's fees, just to be clear about your position? When the default was entered, there was an order for you to pay $2,074 in attorney's fees. You recall that?
Yes, I do, yes.
And let's just assume that you prevail on the issue as to whether or not default should have ultimately been entered. Notwithstanding that, if you prevail on that issue, do you contest the court's decision to order you to pay the $2,000 because you hadn't appeared for the settlement conference and hadn't prepared for the settlement conference? What's your position on that?
I was searching for a copy of that order because I saw it, read it last night, but it said for Mrs. Kimondo to pay the $2,000, which she did not have. But the original order said for her to pay that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I didn't think she should be able to have to pay that. But the original order was ordering her to do that.
You know, the order of entry of default talks about things other than being at the conference, failed to discuss or attempt to negotiate a settlement prior to a conference, failed to have a person authorized to settle present, failed to deliver a confidential settlement letter to the judge 5 days before. Just so I understand your position, is it your position that you failed to do those things because you were not aware that there was a settlement conference at that time?
At that time. And I brought that up to the judge immediately, and when I was filing my additional papers insofar as reconsideration, that we just did not receive that.
And didn't you also say in your motion to set aside what you called a default judgment, which was actually a default, entry of default, didn't you say that you had never received a settlement conference statement or a demand letter from the plaintiffs?
That's correct.
Which is actually required under the settlement conference rules, Rule 12.1.
That's correct, and we never received, they didn't file the settlement conference letter until after the 5 day period. I mean, it was late. So we didn't get that.
When did you get that settlement conference letter?
The settlement conference letter goes to the judge.
But oh, I see, I see.
It was supposed to be submitted 5 days prior to the settlement conference. And that was not
right. Actually, in this case, she actually didn't require everything, right, in terms of the trial setting order.
Yeah, she did not require a
she said conference. Only confidential settlement conference letters required. Confidential. So she wasn't requiring an exchange.
No.
So she kind of deviated from the normal procedure in the settlement conference.
That's right.
Do you, in the event that this case is remanded with the understanding that at that point the plaintiffs can pursue their claims, do you intend to do any further discovery?
We would have to, Your Honor. If he's going to continually ask us for the main issue here was there insurance liability insurance. And immediately when I got this case, I contacted the insurance company. He says, well, no, you didn't, but I've got letters from him to me when I gave him the policy and the policy numbers, the policy slips. And he, in fact, sent letters out to the insurance company to show that Mrs. Camado, asking whether or not Mrs. Camado had insurance. Mrs. Camado did not have any insurance. Okay, and then once I told him that, I thought
meaning she didn't have coverage.
She didn't have coverage.
They denied coverage.
Yes, they denied liability coverage.
Well, I thought they said that she had no liability insurance, that she only had property insurance.
She only had property insurance. That's what I'm saying. She only had property insurance. She did not have liability insurance. I gave him the documents to show that.
And so what discovery are you anticipating that you would pursue?
Well, it's at this point still conditional, but...
Part of the reason I ask that is, have you completed your theory at this point as to why there is no duty?
We would have to go into more into that because of the nature of there being no insurance. I thought he was going to dismiss or drop Mrs. Camado when he found out that for sure there was no liability insurance. This is an elderly woman who doesn't have any money.
Who knows? Maybe he was going to pursue the insurance angle further after getting a judgment. Who knows? But that's not the issue before this court. Do you think that a court can rule as a matter of law that your client did not have a duty because under the circumstances what happened was not reasonably foreseeable?
That's correct. We sided with...
You think that's a question of law?
Yes.
The reasonable foreseeability is a question of law.
That's correct. We felt that it was a question of law. We agreed with the circuit court, with the trial court that actually found that. My understanding was that the court said that there was no duty. That's the first thing they came out with. And then the ICA, Inmate Court of Appeals, affirmed that. Both of them, in my reading, said that there was no duty owed to her. The incident in question, let me back up just for a second. The facts of the case were Mrs. Camado has a home. Her son came over unannounced. It was a Sunday. The incident, the robbery took place, as the circuit court stated, a mile away, hours later, in a parking lot. So it did not occur on the property, on Mrs. Camado's property. So how can you say that Mrs. Camado had a duty to the plaintiffs?
Was Mrs. Camado deposed?
No, I don't believe she was.
Not yet, or had not yet, as of the time the case was resolved by the circuit court.
That's correct. But they, again, back to duty, breach of duty was not necessary. We regard that as a matter of law. I would also like to address the court on a case of...
I'm sorry, was her son deposed? He was not deposed either.
He was still deposed.
And Mr. Higa wasn't deposed either, correct?
That's correct. Okay. The two of them were also in prison. The plaintiffs were continually trying to drag Mrs. Camado in, claiming from one point to another that she was involved in the robbery, and that was just dismissed by the court because there was nothing in the record to show she was ever involved in anything.
Was your client permitted to testify at the motion for default judgment hearing?
No, Your Honor, she was not.
In fact, the court had ruled that your side had no right to be heard, right?
That's correct. We objected to that.
Wasn't their liability claim based totally on what your client says? In other words, their clients don't know what she knew about her son. The issue is whether or not under your client's circumstances, it would have been reasonably foreseeable that her son might try to steal their jewelry. Yet, the court did not even allow your client's testimony, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. On the issue of foreseeability, nobody testified.
Although she was testing whether or not they would be able to establish liability. And the most important witness on that is probably your client.
Mrs. Camilto, correct. Again, the court just said, no, you cannot. The default has been entered. You cannot testify. You cannot do anything further. That was her position. And that was also the position of the plaintiff's attorney at that point.
Can you just address whether there was any basis whatsoever for the judge entering judgment against the plaintiffs? Because it's that entry of judgment that precluded them from, for example, being able to depose your client to try to develop the factual record more that might show or elicit additional facts of her potential knowledge or circumstances that might have made her aware. So was there any basis that you can argue to this court as to why the circuit court had the authority to enter judgment sua sponte, because you told us that you had not moved for it, sua sponte against the plaintiffs?
The court found, once she got to the issue of the prima facie case, that was the controlling factor for her, for the court. They did not, as we've gone over many times, did not prove their prima facie case. She gave them the opportunity, both of the plaintiffs testified at the hearing for about an hour as to the circumstances of what had happened to each one of them individually, how they were robbed, when they were robbed, and who robbed them. Because they were being robbed by not by Mrs. Kimado, and they were not being robbed by Mrs. Kimado's son. So the court basically looked at the prima facie case and came away with the decision that if you can't prove your prima facie case according to the law, then you cannot proceed.
Sounds to me like she was making a factual finding.
How do you respond to the point, Mr. Jones, that at that point in the proceedings, what the purpose of the hearing was to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence to enter judgment, certainly. But on the other hand, since the case hadn't yet proceeded through discovery, there hadn't been an opportunity for a motion for summary judgment, or one hadn't been filed, that the alternatives available to a judge who denies the motion for entry of judgment are to do that, deny the entry of judgment. And at that point, discovery would have to proceed to see whether the parties could further develop their positions as to whether there was liability. So what's your response to that point, that isn't the point, isn't the purpose of the hearing?
That would have been more towards whether or not the court was going to hear on damages rather than liability. My understanding was the court was just dealing with liability because she had both of the plaintiff's attorneys, both of the plaintiffs testifying in front of her.
Well, how else, who could establish damages in terms of the value of the jewelry that was stolen? Wouldn't it be them that would establish the actual damages?
That's what they did. I mean, that is what they did for an hour and a half.
But in terms of this is discovery and motion for summary judgment issue, actually, trial had been set for April 8, 2013. Discovery cutoff was 60 days before that. So discovery was already finished, correct?
That's correct.
And actually, the default was entered based on your failure to appear at the February 13, 2013 settlement conference. So basically, and this hearing on motion for default judgment was 6 months after the trial date that had already been set, right? So if this case is remanded, it would be up to the trial judge to decide whether or not she would reopen discovery or require that the parties proceed to trial based on the discovery that had already been done.
That's correct, but the discovery with both of her, with both of his plaintiffs testifying at length without any cross-examination, she might just as well, might as well just go ahead and say, okay, let's go to trial.
Right.
Okay, but again, if you read her, in reading her decision, reading the trial court's decision, she is saying that still back up, even if we go to trial, it's still subject to a summary judgment motion.
The summary judgment is due 50 days before trial.
I understand, Your Honor, but
there was no MSJ file.
You're talking about a remand now.
Right. But sometimes on remand, if this court rules that the trial court erred in granting judgment against the plaintiff on their motion for default judgment, where does that leave the entry of default against your client?
My understanding is then they would be able just to proceed to trial on issue damages.
Unless the default were set aside.
Unless the default was set aside.
And you had no reason to appeal the denial of your motion to set aside entry of default, because you had actually prevailed.
We prevailed by the circuit court, and we prevailed in the Intermediate Court of Appeal.
And in fact, if the court doesn't set it aside and it goes back for trial, then you have every right to appeal, and we're going to be right back here again.
That's the catch-22 that I think that the Intermediate Court of Appeal was trying to deal with by not dealing with the issue of the issue of setting aside the default or getting into the default. The ICA went on directly into the issues of foreseeability, the issues of duty and breach of duty. And they did not really get into the issues that this court has asked us to rebrief insofar as the abuse of discretion.
Anything further, Mr. Murphy, that you wish to address on the?
No, Your Honor, no.
Are there any other questions from the court?
No.
All right. Mr. Ahuna, your rebuttal. And I'll give you a couple of minutes, so keep it focused. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to just clarify one thing, that the judge did require a proof hearing. It was a proof hearing that was presented, but I think it confused between damage and proof hearing. There was a proof hearing held, and that's where the testimonies were given about the...
What do you mean, proof hearing? Where does that appear as to what was going to be covered at that hearing? Did she issue an order, or was that at a status conference, or what?
It was at the proof of damage. She says she wanted to have a proof hearing, so they had...
At the hearing or before the hearing?
At the hearing.
Right. At the beginning of the hearing, she said, I'm going to require additional...
Yes.
But before that, did your motion say... What was your motion?
For damages. And so it was a sua sponte thing that she did at the hearing. Basically threw a surprise at us. Oh, by the way, I want to hear liability. So, really? So it was a surprise to us when that happened. But...
So you had a motion for entry of default judgment with a hearing date, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And so, as my son indicated, they had rescheduled it to have the issue of the liability issue heard. And so...
So you did have notice that hearing was going to be on liability then?
Yes, we did. But the part that I want to point out is that in this case, there's a sua sponte, there's no motion on their part for a motion of summary judgment for them to enter. I can see that in denying the motion for default judgment, but then rule against us. The second part, which I think was improper, she exceeded those grounds, meaning that there's no motion on their part, and that she took it upon herself to be as a jury and judge and jury on the issue of our liability, and that being that there's not liability against her completely at all. And we feel that in this case where there was no motion on their part to dismiss fine judgment against us, that it was, you know, exceeded her discretion in that.
How was she supposed to exercise her discretion then, Mr. Ahuna, assuming that she found that there was not a basis for liability? What's your position as to what her alternatives were at that time.
My position here is this is a motion for default judgment, and in this case, it was restricted to the question of whether there's any evidence that could be given to a jury to determine if there's any liability or in favor for the move on in this case. And so her decision, her role was not to make a decision, but to see whether or not there's any evidence at all.
And if she found there wasn't sufficient evidence, what is your view as to what action was available to her?
Then the action would be then to, if there was, if there, then to the test is a directed verdict. If there was evidence, and then we would be able to withstand a directed verdict motion, and then basically
So your view is she should have denied the motion for entry of judgment and then done what? Set the case for trial, just proceeded to trial?
And then after she denied a motion for default judgment, yes, proceed to trial.
You know, just occurred to me, in some ways, you were put at a disadvantage for gaining the default. In other words, if there had been no default, there would have been a summary judgment motion, perhaps, although it was so time frame. So it's actually, by getting default, we ended up with this unusual set of proceedings.
Yes.
So what would your position be with regard to the default of Ms. Kamado at this point?
At this point?
Because we're in, again, as Justice Pollack pointed out, if we were to agree with you that the court should not have entered judgment against your client and should have allowed the case to proceed to trial, presumably, then you have this anomalous situation of a case proceeding to trial with a defendant who's in default. What is your client's position about what should be done or what could be done with regard to that default?
I believe in this case that the judge should. If let's suppose they had granted our motion for default judgment, then the issue would be whether or not the issue of damages, whether or not presented any evidence, you know, of damages, and if there were evidence presented, then award us what we had presented. See, we had already, this is a motion for default judgment on the issue of damages that we had supported.
But the court could require you to put on damage evidence of liability, correct?
Evidence of liability.
Which it did. And said you didn't get there.
But it's still, you know, subject to the same prima facie standard that...
you get another shot at the motion or you go to trial?
If it was denied, go to trial.
Okay. And at trial, in your view, should Ms. Kamado have the opportunity to come in and move in light of these new events, and if these events took place as we've talked about, which is the vacating the judgment against you, should she have the opportunity to come in to move to set aside the default so that they can participate?
I think they do. They would have that time, by that time, the most to make the most to set aside.
Okay. Anything further for the court at this time? No questions? Very well. Thank you to both of our counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
This Honorable Supreme Court is adjourned.